Find the life you didn't think was possible with the Jesus you never knew. Together, let's slow down a little and pay better attention to the most significant person in history. Welcome to the podcast, Paying Ridiculous Attention to Jesus, with your host, Rick Lawrence, brought to you by LifeTree. Visit us at JesusCenteredLife.com.
Well, hi, listeners. This is Rick Lawrence, and you're listening to Paying Ridiculous Attention to Jesus. This is actually Season 8, Episode 6 of this podcast, but if you're a longtime listener, you'll know that Episode 5 was recorded about a year ago. And that's because about 3.5 years ago, I left my longtime role at Group and became executive director of Vibrant Faith, which is a ministry resourcing, research, and coaching organization. And when I did that, you might have noticed that I started a slow decline in the number of episodes I was recording, just because I was on so many learning curves in that new role. I just didn't have the physical and emotional bandwidth finally to keep at it. And so I knew I needed to take a break. So I took a year-long break, and now I just feel nudged by the Spirit to start recording again. But there is also another nudge I'll tell you about in just a second for the reason why we're relaunching this podcast. So for those of you who are listening maybe for the first time, again, I'm Rick Lawrence. I'm author of many, many books over the last 2 or 3 decades, including the latest one is really a daily devotional called The Jesus-Centered Daily. It's released a couple years ago. And before that, it was called a book called The Suicide Solution. All of my books are about Jesus. And my upcoming book is called Editing Jesus. And the tagline is a little precocious. It's confronting the distorted faith of the American church. So this new book is really about focusing on the ways that we've left following Jesus to follow other things, Christendom, the Judeo-Christian ethic, all kinds of things that aren't really Jesus. So underneath all of that approach to kind of diagnosing where the church has diverted away from Jesus is really a re-embracing of living in the way of Jesus. And that's what we're going to be doing going forward. Theme-wise, is just exploring the ways of Jesus. And a lot of them will be embedded in my new book, and some won't. But just going to be exploring how Jesus lives, what he values, what his priorities are. So I mentioned this is actually the 6th episode in this series, The Ways of Jesus. And the last one was recorded a long time ago. The second reason that I felt nudged to relaunch this podcast is I just had this idea early one morning, and I thought, I wonder if this was possible. So I reached out to my old partner in podcast crime, Becky, the Beckynator, to see if she might be in a life position to kind of jump back on this podcast train. And she said yes. To my shock, she said yes, she would. And so I just feel like this is a miracle that Becky and I are both in a place where we can be back together on this podcast. It's been a long time. So Becky, welcome back.
Hi, I'm so glad to be here. I like Rick, you know, I had a baby. For those of you who don't know,
Rick. That would be really big news.
I mean, like Rick, I had to take a break. having a baby cleared the deck in my life, so to speak. I had to clear the deck in many ways and just kind of figure out how to do all of the things that I was doing and be a mom. And the answer was that I had to remove most of the things that I was doing in order to be the kind of mom that I wanted to be. And so the last year, I've really just been kind of, well, I guess the last 2 years, I've really just been trying to figure out this little boy, Grant, and who he is and how to be his mom and what else fits in my life with him. And so when Rick reached out, I felt like, you know, I've got a handle on this thing now. I've got I've got a plan. Things are working. And this is a good time for me to come back and use my voice as well. I think it's an important time to be using our voice. So I'm glad to be back.
So good. And for those of you who maybe are just listening for the first time to this podcast, you can go back to the beginning. Probably the first 4 years we did this, Becky and I did this together every week. And it was quite a journey. I feel like doing a podcast together sort of helps you grow together too, because you're learning from each other all the time. And Becky and I are different. You'll hear that as we move through this episode. You'll hear the difference in perspective. And I always felt like from the very beginning that Becky's perspective and the difference in her perspective meshed really well with what I have to say. So, and I prefer, I've been doing this podcast for the last, I don't know, few years, just myself. And while I really enjoyed doing that, it's nothing compared to doing it with a podcast partner you trust. And so I'm just thrilled that Becky is back in the saddle. So every other week, we'll be pursuing the heart of Jesus by taking a deep dive into the way he lives and loves others. That's simply the pursuit that on this podcast, the title says everything. Paying ridiculous attention to Jesus is what we do. And by doing that, we embed ourselves more deeply in our relationship with him. And he calls that the branch and the vine. And when the branch is intimately attached to the vine, the life of the vine comes up through the branch and produces fruit. And the fruit, you can't hold it back there so much, because the life of this vine is the most vigorous life ever. It's the source of all life. So that's our simple pursuit, always simply to pursue the heart of Jesus in all we do. So as I mentioned, we're going to be exploring some themes embedded in my upcoming book, Editing Jesus, in advance of its release, but also we'll go far afield as well. And today we're going to dive into something I call sitting at the wrong end of the table, sitting at the wrong end of the table. So we'll get to that reference in just a second. But first, Jesus was actually quite impractical in most of his teaching. Jesus is always looked at by people as, oh, he was a great teacher. Yeah, but if you look closer, a lot of his teaching was a head scratcher. I mean, he did not make it easy for people very often on purpose. So he used stories and metaphors that people didn't always immediately understand. And he encouraged his followers to do things often that seemed impossible to them. So in this episode, we're actually going to explore maybe his most practical teaching. It was one that happened in the moment. He was responding to something that happened in the moment, like many of the teachings that he gives. But this one was eminently practical. It's not a head scratcher. It's not, you don't have to figure out what he's talking about. But I think it's really important for us in the particular moment of history that we're in right now. So let's start with this. Becky, now we're going to, like, if you've listened to this podcast for a long time, you know, sometimes we go on the loop-de-loop before we get down to the core. And there's a reason for that. So today is no exception. So let's start with this. Becky, you're the parent of a toddler, and you also have one on the way. And it's a whole new, I even though it's been a while for me since I had a toddler in the home, it doesn't seem like that for long ago. I remember what it felt like to have a toddler in the home, but it's a whole new world of figuring out stuff you haven't had to think about before. Like, for instance, how much responsibility and freedom do you give your kids as they grow up? I mean, are they free range kids? Are they tightly controlled kids? Where's the tension point? A lot of that stuff comes from our own upbringing. But as parents, we want to be intentional and figure out, how do we do that? How do we give them responsibility and freedom at the same time? And what's the tension point between those? So let me ask you a couple of questions as a newer parent. So if you think about a shrub trimmer, you know, something that has a blade that goes back and forth and cuts branches and twigs off. So that's a shrub trimmer. At what age do you think it's okay for a kid to use a shrub trimmer on their own? At what age would you think?
Funny, It's funny you should use that particular example, because last year I was out in the backyard and my son picked up a machete that had been left out. My husband had been like working in the garden. He just
I also have many machetes laying around in my backyard.
That he left the machete just, you know, sitting there, and then Grant picks it up and is running through the backyard with it. Like, and I had to catch him, caught him
How
before
old is
mayhem
Grant
happened.
Now?
But
How old
he
is now?
2.5. He's two and a half. And we're at the point where you every day ask yourself, is there more ways that we could childproof this house? Like, is there, because he can just get into everything. Like, you turn around and you're like, how did you even find that? Like, I don't even know where we keep this dangerous object that you are now carrying around. So we're definitely at the point where more childproofing is better. But we're in the middle of a kitchen remodel. Our whole entire kitchen is being remodeled right now. And so there is no childproofing, and there are dangerous objects everywhere in our house right now. And so all I'm doing is spending my time mitigating between this is not something you should be, come over here, let's play with your tractors, you can play with these. So the answer to this question at this point is I don't currently see what age Grant would be responsible enough to use shrub trimmers, but it's probably more than a few years away.
So, would
so
it be,
we'll see how responsible he becomes.
Would it be before 10 years old or after 10 years old in your mind?
I mean, probably for our home, probably it's going to be more than that. We, you know, we're kind of like quasi homesteaders here. We do, you know, we have a machete because we were chopping down old cornfields. So, you know, we do a lot of that kind of work on a regular basis in our backyard. So Grant will probably pick it up. He's already wants to mimic everything we do. So I imagine probably somewhere around 6 or 7, he'll be doing stuff like that. But right now, no way. He should not have shrub trimmers.
So when he picks up a shrub trimmer for the first time and you say you can use this on your own, what restrictions on its use would you give him, do you think?
Well, he's going to spend a lot of time with his dad learning how to use something like that and be, you know, watched doing it for a long period of time before you know that he's responsible enough to be able to handle something like that. And if he doesn't show the maturity for it, then he will not be allowed to use them. So I think it all just depends on
let's do it with
kind
this.
Of kid he is.
So we started with a shrub trimmer / machete. What about like one of those hand can openers, you know, not an electric one, but just a hand can opener where you open
yeah.
the lid on a can. A lot of people probably have never used a hand can opener, but you know, that's a basic manual tool. At what age do you think you would let him use something like that?
Well, right now he would probably take it and like hit something with it. That would be his response. I mean, I don't know. A hand-eye coordination. I don't know what age kids have that kind of hand. I can hardly use a hand can opener to open cans. It's difficult. You have to like clench it. You know, I don't know when he's strong enough to be able to do something like that.
Yeah, when he's strong enough, that's good.
You know,
yeah.
You know, like,
but you don't have the same
coordination of it.
You don't have the same worries as far as the danger.
No,
you would with it.
No,
right? Yeah.
I mean, I would be concerned about him hurting someone else with a can opener.
Yeah,
because
but
like I said, everything
so much,
is
yeah.
like. Not himself as much.
Yeah. Right. Well, so. the reason I'm asking these questions is all of us, when we stop to think about it, we have different standards for different tools when we think about giving our kids freedom and responsibility around stuff like that. And if you think about those are easy to understand tools, a can opener, a hedge trimmer, but there's lots of things we use like tools in our everyday life. And some of them are more dangerous than others. Some of them need greater responsibility and greater maturity to use than others, obviously. And I'd say social media is one of those tools. It's ubiquitous now. 3/4 of the world's population is on one social media platform or another. That is billions of people. Mm-hmm. And we often don't slow down very much to think about these kinds of tools, because, you know, a hedge trimmer, we think, oh yeah, I immediately can see the danger involved in that. But with social media, it's a little more subtle. But social media is a very powerful tool. It's a forming tool. It's clearly forming our young people in a significant way. That's why there's a movement right now in Congress to actually ban TikTok in the United States, because of Chinese influence in it. But it's also, if you listen to some of the rhetoric around that, it's the impact that that platform has on young people and social media in general. So would you say, Becky, that social media as a tool is more like a, on the continuum, is it more like a shrub trimmer, you know, obviously dangerous, or more like a can opener, a little safer than that? Where do you land on that?
I definitely land on the shrub trimmer side of it. You know, I was born in 1981. And so as a college student, you know, Facebook rolled out to different colleges. And so my college was one of the colleges that it was rolled out to when I was, you know, 19 years old, I think. And, you know, back then, I don't even think we really knew what to use Facebook for. You know, we had MySpace before that. We were, you know, posting really silly selfies, and I don't know, we weren't really doing very much with it because we just didn't really know or understand it. But I did really like social media, and I continue to like social media. But for those of you who follow me, I have been very quiet for the last 2 years. I have been extremely quiet. I'm still on there and I'm watching and I'm paying attention, but I'm very cautious about using my voice on social media right now, because I do think that it has an extremely powerful way, not only of leading people down the wrong path, so you being a false influencer, but also I think it has a very powerful way of you being influenced in the wrong direction. And I've become extremely careful about who I follow. And I've set some standards for myself for that. And if they fall off of one of my five standards, I just unfollow immediately. Mm-hmm. I just say this is not right for me anymore, because I just have seen, both in my own life and in my friends' lives, just how it can lead to more captivity and less freedom, truthfully, in our ability to live our everyday lives.
Yeah, and that speaks to, I'd be on the same side with you. I think of social media as more of a shrub trimmer than a can opener, as far as its the latent power of the tool. I agree with you on that. But once we understand that that's true, then that should naturally equate to how we consider responsibility and freedom around that thing. And so the next step is to consider, in what ways is social media actually exerting power in our lives and in the lives of our friends? And you've hinted at a little bit of that, Becky, but let's just talk for just a second. Let's brainstorm for a second about all of the ways that social media can exert power in our lives. And one way that just sticks out to me right away is the kind of the performance mentality that it produces. So a little story here of my daughter, Emma, who's 21 and in college right now. She's actually taken over my social media platforms, because I'm like, I hardly ever post on them. And I have a new book coming out. And what's expected of an author is to be pretty active on those platforms. And I've tried, I've disciplined myself. I do things on those platforms, but it's not my wheelhouse. I'm not drawn to it. And so I asked my daughter, who's really good on those platforms, if I could hire her for an hour a week to go on there and create posts about my upcoming book. And then I edit what she comes up with and she posts them. So at the very first time she posted something on Facebook about my book, it was a series of slides. I think you call it a carousel. Soon, like within 5 or 10 minutes, somebody in my Facebook world posted on there and said, "Hey, there's a spelling mistake on one of your slides. How can you be a longtime editor and writer and have a mistake that obvious on one of your slides? So they posted this, and my daughter, Emma, texts me right away and says, Dad, somebody just posted on your post. I can't believe how mean they are. What kind of place is this Facebook? Because she's mostly on Instagram, like most young people are. They don't really go on Facebook that much. So Facebook is a new territory for her. She's like, people would never do this on Instagram. And I wrote her back and I said, oh, Emma, I've had so much of this, you know, kind of reaction to things that I post over the years. It's like, doesn't make me bat an eye. I responded to the person kind of lightheartedly, said a joke about it and said, you know, it was a mistake. I'm going to fix it. But my daughter was just horrified at the way people treat each other on Facebook. And it's because she's been really formed by the expectations of the environment of Instagram. And you only say certain things to each other. And it means that if you think about it, if you step back from this, you're always performing on the social media platform that you're on. You're adhering to the standards of that platform and you're adjusting the truth about you to whatever that platform requires. Like if you post something, if you're a young college student like my daughter and you post a picture of yourself, what you expect to get from all of your friends on there is how great you look. And if your friend does not post on how great you look there, then there's something wrong. There's an etiquette that you have to follow on there and it's forming. So that's one of the powerful influences I think that social media has. It creates kind of a performance mentality. What else comes to your mind, Becky?
There's a lot of positive things that it creates as well. Like my husband and I are both very much interested in homesteading and just kind of living off the land. Neither of us, well, he has more experience than I do, but I have zero experience growing up. So everything I've learned about it is self-taught. And there's just a wonderful wealth of information from, you know, homesteaders who have been doing this for, you know, generations, who are teaching you about how to preserve food and how to grow food and how to take care of animals. And I wouldn't, honestly, I don't know how I would navigate what we do on our little tiny homestead if I didn't have all of that help, right? I mean, you go on and you save posts, you learn things, you learn about the soil, you learn about how to, you know, deal with bugs and insects. There's so many great things. There's also really encouraging people on there. I was going through a season adjusting to motherhood where I was just feeling so exhausted and overwhelmed. And someone shared this account with me, and this woman has 7 children. And I was like, oh my gosh, you know what you're doing. And she's a Christian and she's just a lovely person. And her posts about peaceful parenting and parenting with the Bible were so encouraging to me and helpful, helpful in helping me through a hard season. So there's a lot of really, really good things on social media. You just have to tune your antenna to the right things. Yeah. And the problem is that social media is constantly trying to tune your antenna to the wrong things, because within your feed are the people that you've chosen to follow. And then they're constantly suggesting other things that are supposedly based on your interests. But like you said about performance, I can't seem to get away from, as a woman who is 42 years old, from Instagram wanting to push people and accounts on me that want to try harder to get better at everything. It's like, I'm constantly having to say, I'm not interested in this, hide this post, I don't want to see this. But regardless of me constantly trying to tell Instagram, this isn't who I am, this isn't what I want content for, they're constantly throwing it into my feed. You have no control over that, right? So you have to be a discerning person if you're going to be there and say, this isn't going to influence my life. I'm not going to pay attention to this. I'm going to be here for what I am here for, which is the good stuff.
Yeah. And you touched on something I think is really important too, that social media, if you think about back in the day, you used to hear this phrase, keeping up with the Joneses, which was the power of comparison in your life. Like, what did your next door neighbor just get a new car? Oh, now I feel pressure. What, my car looks so dingy compared to their new car. So keeping up with the people in your neighborhood. When social media got traction, then now it's not keeping up with the Joneses, it's keeping up with the world. Like the comparison engine that social media represents has enclosed the entire world. And so there's actually a psychosocial dynamic that I write about in Editing Jesus. There's a chapter called The Siren Song of Platforming. And we're going to be talking about that a little bit in just a second. But in that chapter, I talk about a psychosocial dynamic called personal relative deprivation, PRD, personal relative deprivation. It essentially means that we build up resentment when we believe we've been deprived of certain deserved outcomes compared to others. So we build up this kind of latent background resentment. And there have been in-depth studies into the impact that social media has. And what they've discovered is that this personal relative deprivation has been magnified uniquely, like no other thing in human history, by social media. So it creates a kind of comparison engine. And connected to that also, I think, is a kind of casual narcissism, what I mean by that is it redirects our focus on ourselves all the time. And it just feeds into that sort of interior longing we have to be seen and enjoyed. But in this case, it forms us into people who are platforming ourselves all the time. We're giving the best version of ourselves all the time. And we're hoping by doing that to gain followers and influence and people that are pushing the like button on there. And all of this, as we talked about before, has the power to form us. The great philosopher Marshall McLuhan said famously, the medium is the message. And what he means by that is the conduits of the message have more power to form us than the message itself. So you could think of social media as one of those conduits that is powerfully forming us. One of the ways that it's forming us is this sort of self-directed focus. You could call it self-promoting, you could call it casual narcissism, but it is a definite lure of social media. And that's where we get to Jesus. So where would Jesus land in this space? Because although these tools are new, are obviously new in the last two decades, for sure, so that these tools were nothing anyone could have imagined in the time of Jesus, this dynamic was still in play. The dynamic of who's the most important person in the room here? Is it me? That it's a human magnetic draw to that. So let's give a little appetizer here, and then Becky, you and I can dive into this story that I promised that we would take a deeper dive into. So here's the appetizer. It's one of Jesus's blistering critiques of the Pharisees. Here's what he said about them. So the Pharisees, if just to set the context, Jesus is teaching in the public square. The Pharisees are there, but so are a lot of other people. And so as he does on many occasions, he's referencing the religious leaders who are standing right there and talking about them to everyone else who's standing there. So here's what he says. Everything they do is for show. On their arms, they wear extra wide prayer boxes with scripture verses inside, and they wear robes with extra long tassels, and they love to sit at the head table at banquets and in the seats of honor in the synagogues. They love to receive respectful greetings as they walk in the marketplaces, and they love to be called rabbi. That's from Matthew 23. So here Jesus is just hammering these religious leaders for all the show, the big show and performance that they live out amongst everybody else. So Becky, what do you, when you look at this, this little appetizer here, the Jesus' critique of the Pharisees, why do you think he's so worked up about this?
Well, Jesus doesn't, I mean, if you look at what the Bible says about leaders and what it says about leadership, there's a, I mean, Matthew 20, 26, he says, for those who are going to become greater, they need to be a servant. John 3:30 says, if you want to become greater, become less. You know, James 3:1 says that teachers will be judged more strictly. Philippians 2:3 says, do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, and humility value others above yourself. Mm-hmm. So when we look at what is Jesus' value in leadership, he is constantly pointing to being less, serving more, having humility. And so what these Pharisees, as religious leaders, they don't look like that. They look like they're serving themselves, that they're, you know, pumping themselves up. I think what's interesting about now is that a religious leader you would think of as like a pastor today, right? Like maybe they're a pastor or a ministry leader, a professional in ministry. But with social media, you can go on and have a platform as a Christian without going through any of the pastoral processes, you know?
Yeah.
Churches have elder systems and they have hiring systems and they have leadership standards that they hold people to that are biblical leadership standards. And so here we are on social media, and in the last 5 years, we have seen these Christian leaders, influencers, authors, pastors who have had major meltdowns. We have seen them go from leading marriage conferences to getting a divorce. We have seen them, selling us that, you know, this try harder to get better method of Jesus that ended up with them overdosing and dying of drug overdose. And just this huge disappointment that we have seen from major Christian influencers in our time that that ended up not being quite what they seemed, right? There was a facade. There was a lack of you know, authenticity to what was really happening in their lives. And so I think a lot of us have taken a step back and said, who are we listening to?
Yeah.
Who should we be listening to? And yeah. I think that points to what you're pointing at here, is that Jesus is angry at this. And I think he would be angry with what he's seeing right now.
Yeah. And the first thing he says to your point, Becky, is everything they do is for show. So we've heard this before and we think, oh yeah, I know what that looks like. But everything they do is for show is just another way of saying they're always performing for the people around them. And this is why social media, in my view, is a hedge trimmer. It's if it's orienting us toward doing everything for show, then we're being nudged into this territory that is really dangerous. And you just described why it is, because that kind of leadership or that kind of way of living has a hollow foundation. It's not going to stand up. It's going to be easily toppled. And this is not just a teaching that Jesus gives about sort of an other-centered way of living or a non-performance way of living. He modeled this as well. I mean, over and over again. There was a moment, one of my favorite moments in his ministry was when he was at the height of his popularity and the people were convinced that he was the Messiah in the way that they understood what Messiah was supposed to do, which is come in and wipe out the Roman occupiers from their land. And that's what they expected him to do. And they were convinced that this guy had enough power and influence that he could do it. And so they were buzzing about how to install him as their king. And Jesus understood what was happening and he slipped away. He slipped away. So at the very moment when he could have captured all of that energy, he instead just dissipated it by disappearing. He got out of there. He was not interested in taking advantage of that situation so that he could exercise that kind of power in that moment. So when we think about why Jesus was so worked up about this, I think it leads well into the story I said we would take a deeper dive into. So what exactly is sitting at the wrong end of the table? Well, here's the story. So Jesus was invited to an important dinner by a religious leader. And the only guests that were there were important people. And Jesus shows up. For those of you who are always late to things, you might take note that Jesus also was often late to things, usually on purpose. So he shows up a little bit late to this gathering, and the other people are already there, and they're all jockeying for places to sit because they're driven by performance. They want to be seen as the most important people at this gathering. So here's the story from Luke 14. When Jesus noticed that all who had come to the dinner were trying to sit in the seats of honor near the head of the table, he gave them this advice. When you're invited to a wedding feast, don't sit in the seat of honor. What if someone who's more distinguished than you has also been invited? Well, the host is going to come up and say, give this person your seat. Then you're going to be embarrassed, and you'll have to take whatever seat is left at the foot of the table. Instead, take the lowest place at the foot of the table. Then when your host sees you, he'll come on and say, friend, we have a better place for you. And then you'll be honored in front of all the other guests. For those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Now, I said at the start that I think this is one of Jesus' most practical teachings. He's not trying to shame these people into behaving better at this dinner party. He's just telling them, practically speaking, what you're doing doesn't make any sense. If you vault yourself to the place of honor and you miss, and the host comes and says, no, that seat's reserved for someone else, it's totally embarrassing. So take the lowest place. Now, he's not saying that in all cases, that host is going to come and say, oh, you shouldn't be sitting here. What if you sit at the lowest place and that's your seat? What if the host doesn't come up and say, you deserve a better place of honor? So what Jesus is saying is very practical and strategic and shrewd. He's saying, you guys, you're doing the wrong thing here. And I just find it so enjoyable that Jesus could have simply said what he had said to the Pharisees before, that the only thing you're interested in is the show. Instead, he's getting at them kind of from the side here. So let's consider this teaching moment and its implications for our relationship with social media as we acknowledge the power that's at work in it. So Becky, in your mind, what is the practical core of what Jesus is teaching here? And how does it make a difference in our approach to social media, do you think? So what do you think is the essence of what he's trying to get at here?
Yeah, a few of my friends have been talking lately about re-engaging in social media. I think all of us sort of during COVID took a huge step back and just, we all got quiet, to be honest. We just got really quiet and we observed and we were trying to figure out how do we honor God in this place anymore? Or do we just not be here? And I think each of us went through seasons where we weren't there and we've wrestled with it, but we kind of came up with five sort of standards that we feel like are biblical standards of approaching social media. And I think that these five standards, they apply to whether or not you're going on and you're having a voice on social media and you're, I mean, essentially a platform, you're using it as a platform to have a voice, or if you're following people and you're allowing them to influence your life. I think these five questions fit regardless. So the first one is it glorifying you or is it glorifying him? So when we're going on social media, are we glorifying ourselves or are we glorifying God while we're there? The second is it what we're saying? Is it about his message or is it about our message? And I think this goes back to dependence. Are we using a dependent relationship with Jesus to say, Jesus, what do you have for me to say here? If this is a place where you're going to use your voice, am I just a conduit of that? The third one is, are you being responsible to the biblical standards of leadership? Do you know what the biblical standards of leadership are? Do you understand that by using your voice and having a platform, you have biblical standards that have been set for you and that you need to follow those? And are you also holding the people that you follow to those same biblical standards of leadership? And then, is what you're sharing authentic or fake? Are you faking up your post, or are you being authentic? And authentic might mean that if you're going through a hard time in your marriage, you're not going to talk about marriage right now. You're going to say, we're going through a hard time in our marriage, and I don't think I can talk about this. Or just choosing to take a break because your life isn't in the right place. Pastors do that. Leaders do that. My life is in the right place. I need to step down from my role for a while and get things back on track. And we have to do that in social media too. And then the last one is, are you honoring your spouse? Because a lot of these divorces that have happened from these like major, you know, Christian influencers, it's come out that one of the spouses felt like the social media presence became more important than the marriage. And that there was posts or ways that things were being posted that they were uncomfortable with, whether they were using their family or whatever. You're still called to honor your marriage within your social media platform. And if the person you're following isn't doing that, or if you're not doing that, I think that's something you have to ask yourself as you're entering into this road, because this is a place of privilege. It is a privilege to have a voice to billions of people, right? I mean, you have the opportunity to reach billions of people. So you are going to be more judged more strictly as a Christian if you're using that platform and you follow Jesus. That's just the way it's going to be.
Yeah, I think if you take out the specific target of social media out of your five things there, you could easily translate those into that dinner party that Jesus walked into. These are the same things that he's trying to point out with them. He's just doing it in a sideways way. One of the interesting things, I put a story in Editing Jesus about the Asbury Awakening, this student awakening at Asbury College that happened in early 2023. And it was a kind of a worldwide phenomenon that eventually about 100,000 people came from all over the world to see what was happening in this, at this little school, in this little chapel. And all that really happened was some students stayed after normal campus worship time. They stayed after praying and worshiping. They just didn't feel like leaving. They just felt the intimate presence of Jesus in that space, and they just didn't want to leave. So they didn't. And pretty soon other students on campus found out they were doing that, and they felt the same nudge, and they ended up praying and worshiping 24/7 in this little chapel. And they didn't do it just for a couple of days. It went on for weeks. And that's what caught the attention of the news media and people around the world. And in my book, I write a little bit about this. Pete Gregg, who's the founder of the 24/7 prayer movement, went to Asbury to see what was happening for himself, to see it firsthand. And he said one of the extraordinary things about going there was when he walked into the chapel for the first time, that it was low tech. There was no performance standards at all in that room. He said, you know, whoever's leading worship might lead the same worship song for 30 minutes. There was no sense that they were trying to platform this into something bigger. And actually a news organization came to Asbury and said, we want to do a news story about this. And the student leaders of this said, no. They said, I love what they said. They said, the only person to spotlight here is Jesus. That's it. He's the only one on the platform, not us. We don't want that. And the news person said, there's only two reasons that people decline media coverage. One is they're trying to hide something, and clearly you're not doing that. And the other is when they don't need media coverage for whatever it is that's happening. And he said, you're in that category. You, for whatever reason, you're not craving it. And when we hear a story like this, we're just, a part of us is a little bit like, oh my gosh, that sounds so great. Those students denied something, rode against the current with something that is really hard for young people to do today. They said no to more platforming energy toward the thing they were doing because of the very thing that I think you just said, Becky, is it authentic? And what they were saying is, we don't want more performance barnacles attached to what we're doing here. We don't care if the news media is here. We don't care if people come from around the world to see this. What we're really doing is paying attention to Jesus. And so when you think about what we're talking about here, Becky, that Jesus is always and at every moment loving the people in front of him. And you think about what he says to this gathering of dinner guests. So we know by definition what he's saying to them is the best way he can love them. So by extension too, how is what Jesus is doing here an expression of love toward us? How do you translate that into his love for us?
Well, in a lot of ways, he's inviting you off of the hamster wheel. And he's saying you don't have to try so hard. You don't have to compete all the time. You don't have to be the best or be in the front of the line. That's exhausting. Aren't you tired? You know, just come over here, sit down. The food's just as good on this side of the table. You know, I just think it's an invitation to relax and not have to take life in this way that we're just naturally drawn. We are so naturally drawn to trying harder to get better. We are so naturally drawn to living our life in a way that is go, go, go all the time, constantly achieving. It's exhausting. And just even looking at the posts on social media make me exhausted. They just make me really, really exhausted. And I think Jesus is just saying, you don't have to do this. Just slow down.
Yeah, it's freeing. It's freeing to hear him say that the core of all of this, of following me, is abiding and remaining in me. That's it. That is the core of what it means to follow Jesus, is to abide and remain in him. And he's inviting us out of that hamster wheel when he says that, and into a word. I love this word that you've used several times already, Becky. He's inviting us into dependence rather than self-actualization and our path forward being all sort of located in our own engine. He's asking us to switch that, and like that branch attached to the vine, abide. We get the life and energy of our life from him instead of self-producing it. And there's lots of Christian ways to self-produce that energy. We cloak it. But what Jesus is inviting us into is a much kinder, more unconditional environment. So one of the things I was thinking about is, as I was writing the book, editing Jesus, the editor asked me to add a personal explanation or example of how I consciously, intentionally avoid platforming, because as an author and a Christian leader, it's always a pressure for me to platform myself. So he asked me, how do you actually do this in your everyday life? Can you add an example of that into the book? And what I added was this phrase, that in my heart and mind, what I'm always trying to do is sit at the wrong end of the table, meaning I want to be at the end of the table where Jesus is, because that's where he's hanging out. If you think about who Jesus hung out with, it wasn't the power brokers or the platformers. It was the people that were perfectly content being off the radar. They just loved being around Jesus. They didn't need him to prop them. In fact, when James and John and their mother said, can they have the places of honor in the future in the kingdom of God? And Jesus said, no. But they were trying to elevate themselves. And Jesus is saying, no, that's not the path forward, elevation. So sitting at the wrong end of the table to me means sitting at the end of the table where Jesus likes to sit. And the mission of my life is to be as close to him as I can get, whatever that looks like, with all of my brokenness and messed upness. How close can I get to Jesus? Well, if he's sitting at the wrong end of the table, then that's where I want to sit. And if you're sitting there with Jesus, I don't care if the host comes and gives me a better place of honor. I just don't care. It's not because I'm more virtuous. It's because I have a bigger, deeper love that overshadows that natural longing to be honored and seen and propped. There's something deeper and better that I'm gravitating to. So I see you shaking your head there. Becky, do you want to add something?
Oh, I was just thinking of a conversation that I had with Steph where we were talking about, you know, just some projects that we're working on and that we're dreaming about. And we said it would be so awesome if we could make this successful without social media. I mean, that was really on our heart, was that we really just didn't want to have to go to that world and try, you know, we didn't want to have to go perform every single day and try to win the popularity contest as a way to market what we're doing in order to be successful. And we both just said, isn't it sad that we've come to the point where if you have a great idea or if you have a great product or if you have something that you want to get the word out about, that the answer to that is usually social media today. But social media takes something. It has a cost that's greater than money. And it costs something that we were both just like, oh, I really hope we don't have to pay this cost.
Yeah. And
I hope we don't have to.
And you're pointing out too that, like, let's take the dinner party example here. Jesus is saying, don't go to the dinner party. He's saying, show up to the dinner party with a different mindset. And that's, I think, what you're really advocating here is if we're going to go on social media, show up with a different mindset. What would it look like for you to show up on social media and think in your inside, I'm always going to sit at the wrong end of the table when I go on social media? What would that look like? It doesn't mean avoiding the hard place to be. It means going in differently. And when you go in differently, you're also a seed for some kind of transformational change. So, and kind of close off here, Jesus is not, if you step back and think about this, he's not shaming these dinner guests into humility. That's what we think Jesus often does. Oh, he's going to shame people into changing their behavior. He's not doing that. He's just pointing out how practically flawed their behavior is. So the bottom line is we can't seize honor. It's bestowed. And it's not always bestowed fairly. That's the other truth. Some people who are deserving of honor never get it. And some people who aren't really deserving of honor do get it. So he's really saying something that's in contrast to this human urge that we have to self-promote. And he's suggesting we self-demote instead. Instead of self-promote, we self-demote. Now, I have to say something really important here. A lot of Christians think that means when they are complimented for something, that their answer to that should be, thank you, but that's all God, not me. But that's just not true. That's a diminishment and a deprecation of the glory of God in us. And it's also not true. It's never all God and zero me. That's just not true. That's false humility. And that's not even what God wants. What Jesus wants is to do stuff with us. It's our agency and his agency and what we put on the table and what he puts on the table. He loves that. He loves to do things in community. Thank you, but that's all God, not me. Sounds humble, but it's not. It's just a different form, twisted form of arrogance, I think. So it's never all God or all us. So humility, this is something to think about as we close off here. Humility never requires us to diminish who we are. It's a warning about promoting who we are. It's not diminishing that's the danger. It's the promotion that is the danger. It's back to Rick Warren's kind of iconic statement, true humility is not thinking less of ourselves, but thinking of ourselves less. Thinking of ourselves less. Yeah. So I have a little closing story from a pastor in Australia named Mark Sayers that will put the exclamation mark on the end of this. But before I do, Becky, any last thoughts?
I just think right now is a really great time to clean up your feed. You know, just we're going into another saucy period of elections. Yes. And I think, you know, who are we listening to is important. And I'm certainly not saying is that you shouldn't hear from different sides of a perspective. You know, I think it's good to hear other people's perspectives on different things. But I do think that who is influencing my life? And I know that especially, you know, being a young mom, when there was a lot of like sitting around in the beginning years, there's a lot of sitting around. Yes. And so it's easy to just pick up the social media feed just as a way to like pass the time.
Right. Yeah.
It's not terribly exciting to play with a, you know, a 6-month-old baby. They want you there, but they don't really want you to interact. And so you just sit around a lot. And so thinking through, what is this scroll? What does it look like? How am I tuning the antenna of my social media to be a place that encourages me, that lifts me up, that helps my marriage, that helps me be a better parent, that helps me draw closer to Jesus, that teaches me new skills? Those are all great things, that aligns with things that I'm interested in, that has, you know, something to do with my hobbies. This is all why social media was created, but it's become something totally different. And so don't be afraid to use that unfollow button or the mute button, or to just clean up your, what is in your antenna, and just start to focus on that. Cause it can be a very positive place when you do that.
That's so good. Yeah.
And then also think about how are you speaking on social media? What are the words that you're saying, and how are you aligning yourself with the Bible calls you to align yourself when you're speaking on social media? What expectations do you have for that time and space?
So good. Thank you for that. And let me just close off by reading this little excerpt from Editing Jesus. Again, it's about Mark Sayers, who's pastor of Melbourne's Red Church, and he's also host of a great podcast called The Rebuilders Podcast. And here's what he says about a season of his life in his pastoral ministry. So I'm just going to read this little excerpt from my book. Sayers describes a season in his life and ministry that was overshadowed by exhaustion and a descent into bipolar disorder. His psychiatrist recommended quiet and rest, and then he got the upending news that he and his wife would soon have twins. So one day in the middle of his sermon, he became disoriented and walked off the stage and out of the church building. After such a public self-demotion, he was worried he'd no longer be welcomed or trusted in ministry. But instead, his congregation responded with compassion and help. They elevated him. And from this experience, Sayers learned what it means to sit at the wrong end of the table. This is him speaking now. The way I had measured success was wrong. It wasn't about retweets and book sales and buzz. It was about dying to self in public. It was not about building a career or a name. It was about operating out of complete dependency upon God. He was far more interested in what he wanted to do in me than what I was doing. So I became focused on passing the baton to others, stepping out of the way so others could flourish. To sit, now this is me talking again here, to sit at the wrong end of the table is to trust God as the source of our identity, so not our platform position. So there's a deep security in this. Becky just mentioned that, because we're no longer beholden to our promotional skills. We can simply relax in our seat with other broken, imperfect, dependent people, none of us campaigning for seats of honor. Well, that's it for episode 6 of season 8. Again, this is Paying Ridiculous Attention to Jesus. It's a podcast right now from ricklawrence.com, my website. Is the producer of the podcast. Go figure. You can subscribe to this podcast on Google Play or iTunes. And what we'll do is we'll include links and references to the things Becky and I have talked about in the post of this episode. So you can look for those things there. And Becky and I will see you again in a couple of weeks. Bye, Becky.
Bye.